Howdy there, everyone. I am Brother Francisco Whitaker, and this is All Good in the Brotherhood podcast. Joining me over the phone are my two brothers, the good, bad, and the ugly. That's the three of us. You can determine which one is which. So we got my older brother Tom on the phone and my younger brother Nate. So the three of us make up the Brotherhood. So how's it going, my guys?
I think I'm just going to say I'm the bad because, yeah, I don't know.
There you go. That's actually a really safe one to make.
Yeah, I'm not going to be holier than thou and say I'm the good, but I'm also not going to just destroy myself. So I'm just going to stick with the bad influence, bad everything. But my day's going well, so yeah.
Yeah, and I'll flip the coin. I'll be the good one. I'll just own it. I know I'm the good brother.
So. That was smart because Now then you force me to be the ugly one.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, once you pick it, it's sort of like who wants the you know, when you're picking your team for kickball, somebody's going to get picked last. And, you know, it's sort of like it's a very Darwinian practice that we enter into, you know, when it's time to pick your team captains and then figure out who you want on your team. There's no way to mince that, you know? So I'm good.
Great.
And even though I'm sick, I'm good. I'm a good boy.
Nice try. But yeah, well, okay. I guess I'm just the ugly duckling then. It's okay. You know, at the end, I turn into a swan, right? So maybe I'm ugly now, but at the resurrection of the righteous, maybe I'll be, you know, top dog. I don't know. We'll see. Anyways, that's random. But it's supposed to be...
I'm screwed if we're talking about the resurrection, if I'm just the bad, but whatever.
Ooh, that's true. That's true.
You know, ugly duckling's a cute vibe. I could see you doing that, but don't worry. You got that swan events coming around. So, yeah, it's always kind of funny when we do these phone conversations because I can't see either of your faces, but...
It's for reactions. I don't know why.
I just felt the need to say that, yeah.
Yeah, well... There you go. That's the truth. Yeah, I know. That's why, like, I like them over the phone, but I also don't. It's good to get all of us together, which is kind of hard to do in person sometimes. But anyways, speaking of the resurrection of the righteous, or the resurrection, did you know that out of Catholics polled by a Pew Research survey that was done back in, I think it's 2021, that of the Catholics polled, 10% of them didn't even believe that heaven existed.
You know what? I feel like my expectations are so low these days after that poll that came out a few years ago that revealed that only 30% of Catholics believe in the real presence of the Eucharist.
Yeah.
Considering that's one of the most important dogma in our faith. It kind of doesn't surprise me that 10% wouldn't believe in heaven. It's disappointing for sure. It's sad, but it's almost not surprising to me. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Tom, on that poll?
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, it kind of fits in the bill of like, I feel like I've encountered a few people at this point in my life who will say something to the effect of, I'm Catholic or I'm Christian. And then you start asking basic questions about what that means. And they, I mean, I feel like I've met Christians who have, you know, polytheistic views, you know, and these are people who say they're Christians and they have somehow this idea that they're, oh no, there are like multiple gods and, you know, like Mother Nature is a real, you know, entity, a religious or like a spiritual being, you know, and so again, that's not necessarily specific to Catholics, but kind of what you're saying, Nate, my expectations have steadily gotten lower and I feel like 10% is, while it's a very significant number, considering there are people who would self-identify as Catholic to say, oh yeah, but I also don't believe in this whole end state that we're theoretically driving towards. That's a significant number. And then at the same time, there's so many people that are culturally Catholic, culturally Christian, and it means from a theological or even a philosophical perspective, absolutely nothing to them other than the closest, the thing that they could spell the most easily, or the thing that they think they are, even if they don't really know what that is. So yes, again, doesn't surprise me, continues to disappoint me. Yeah, that's a reality. So.
Yeah. And I don't know, like in this survey, what they like qualify when they say like this person says they're Catholic, like because, you know, someone could say, oh, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm a Catholic, like you said, and then nothing that they actually believe aligns with anything truly professed by the church. So, yeah, whether these are people who are practicing their faith in, you know, the external sense of going to Mass, or who are praying, or if it's just, well, I was baptized Catholic 30-some-odd years ago and haven't really done anything with it, but I guess I'm Catholic. I wish I could know that breakdown, because I would love to know, like, okay, how many people who are sitting in the pews come every week and still don't believe that there's something beyond this life? Because if you don't believe that, then why the heck are they even in church?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I've thought similar things with the doctrine of the Eucharist.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, how many people are just attending Mass thinking this is purely symbolic? But it's interesting. I think also some polls have shown somewhere around 30 to 40% of Catholics attend Mass regularly. So I think I would be willing to bet that it roughly lines up with the 30% that actually believe in the Eucharist. And so I'm sure, I would hope at least, that all those people believe at least in heaven. Otherwise, yeah, it seems like to raise the question, why are they even invested? Why are they even trying? Why are they even going to Mass? But, you know, we really have the religion of the wheat and the chaff. It's just, and we see it as a church as a whole, among the whole supposedly billion Catholics that there are in the world. But we even see it in our own hearts, how we have this, these desires towards good, but these conflicting moments and temptations towards evil. But I think, yeah, it's just really interesting that we have a very non-idealistic church, in the sense that Christ lets the weeds grow with the wheat. And, you know, we won't have that clear separation until the end of time when we all go to eternity. But in the meantime, we're kind of in the situation with this church, which has the best people in history. Like, the best people in history have all been Catholics. Those have been the saints. But also, arguably the worst people in history have also all been Catholics. And so we're in this weird situation as a religion, I think. And I think polls like the one you just mentioned highlight that reality.
Yeah, and there's even more to this poll, actually. That's like the last question. And the one that I actually wanted to spend more time on was with the very first, the leading question of this survey asks, and it wasn't just asking Catholics, it was also asking other denominations, so some like mainline Protestants, evangelicals, historically African-American, Pentecostal churches, or like the original American Protestants. And this is particularly in America that this poll is being taken. But the first question was that my religion, do you believe that your religion is the one true faith heading to, leading to, eternal life in heaven? And then it follows up with, then do you believe that other Christian religions could also lead to heaven? Do you believe that other non-Christian religions can lead to heaven? And again, the Catholics seem to have like some of the lowest numbers in regards to believing that their own faith is the true faith that leads to eternal life, and profess like the largest number, saying that, oh, other Christians, other religions, those can all lead to eternal life as well. And our numbers reflect a lot more like mainline Protestantism versus like evangelicals or Pentecostal, or a little bit more hard and fast in believing that only their faith is the one that gets to heaven. So just curious, first, your reaction to that, about Catholics kind of believing in a, it seems like a pluralism, not only in denomination, but even in religion. What do you think, and why do you think, like, Catholics have come to believe that, even though the doctrines of the church have been very clear throughout centuries and reiterated at the Second Vatican Council, which is often considered like, oh, well, the church, like, became super universal at that point in, like, acceptance of everything. This church is very clear, even in the Second Vatican Council, that, like, it is only through the church that salvation exists. I'll start with Tom this time. What do you think about that, or why do you think that's the case?
Sure. So I'll try to wear like, I'll play both sides of the coin here, just for the sake of kind of flushing out maybe different ideas or reasons why that might be the case. And I guess we'll start with the reaction. So the reaction on the side of maybe why Protestants might be a little bit more willing to kind of hold to their truths as being the only truths, and that anything kind of outside of their paradigm is false enough to be clearly outside the boundaries of what that truth is. I think that's kind of reflective of even just how Protestantism kind of came to being, which was kind of always on a more aggressive footing. You know, it came out of an era where there were challenges, you know, in the church, and there were challenges with Catholics and Catholicism in Europe. And so it sort of had to, from the beginning, be revolutionary in a lot of ways and a lot more, you know, a lot more kind of a volatile footing than Catholicism, which in some ways may have grown lazy over the years. Mm. And I think, I shouldn't say may have, I think Catholics have grown lazy and over the years in their own beliefs. And you can see that in, this reminds me, and we just had my son baptized this last weekend, and Nate and I were sort of chuckling at the juxtaposition that you can see in the film The Godfather, where you have this scene where the main character is having his it's his godson, right? Or is it his actual son, Nate? I forget.
No, it's not his son, it's his godson. Yeah.
Okay, his godson getting baptized.
It's like me, his nephew.
While he in the middle of, you know, a number of fellow crime bosses who are getting the hit put on him. So just that juxtaposition there of very strictly cultural only, not meaningful adherence to true teaching. But anyway, to get back to that, just like I think Protestantism has always been probably a little bit more on an aggressive and defensive footing than Catholics have been. I think the fuel that's probably made that worse, though, is the rise of this secularist humanist encroachment into the Catholic, not Catholic, actual Catholic teaching, but in reality, but maybe in some ways Catholic teaching and practice at a more local level, where, you know, you may have, you know, priests or even bishops who are more willing to sort of promulgate messages and themes of kind of broader acceptance of varying perspectives and engaging in dialogue, which, you know, again, I think we've talked about this before. Catholics are and ought to be ecumenical, but that doesn't necessarily come from a standpoint of, well, your truth is just as good as my truth over here. It's still intended to be that we have the fullness of truth is a phrase that I've heard. And what that means is it's the center of the bullseye, and anything not on the center of the bullseye is not the center of the bullseye. They're not multiple centers of that dartboard. And so I think, what I think has happened, though, is that even that analogy carries some level of, you know, well, you're in the ballpark, so you're okay. That is a bit of a dangerous space to be in. Because that's where you don't want to let that kind of invade our understanding of what the truths of the faith ought to be. It's not to say that can't help us understand how we can approach, you know, individuals who are, whether they're Protestants or, you know, non-Christians or secular. I mean, I know just by being willing to have conversations where you still at least let somebody, for example, say what they believe. Let somebody explain what they believe and why they believe, which some folks might say, there's really no point in that. It's just, you know, just tip of the spear, lead it forward. You know, you dominate that conversation with what, and maybe the crusader mentality is something to kind of live by. But I know I've had success. I have a good friend who just got married shortly after going through RCIA, and he is a fellow, a good friend of mine who I know it was a meaningful conversion, and I can, you know, say just like the conversations that he and I had over the last like 9-10 years, I'm sure were, you know, a part of that. And they were, you know, inherently willing to, again, hear where he was coming from. So I think, again, engaging in an ecumenical dialogue is a good thing. But we can't go so far as to sort of like start copping out and being, well, you know, it's kind of all on the same same dartboard. So as long as you're on the dartboard, we're kind of all good.
Mm.
Anyway, but yeah, you know, that's my reaction in a nutshell. And yeah, I don't know, Nate, if you had any gut thoughts out of the gates on that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think you covered a lot of good points on that, and my thoughts are similar, but just specifically, I feel like there's sort of two sides to the guilt, if you want to say. There's some guilt here, I would say the fact that we Catholics have lost a sense of how singularly true and above all other faiths our church is. I think the fact that we've lost that sense is really a tragedy. But as far as who's to blame for that, I really think there's kind of a couple sides to it. So on one hand, this is kind of the case with any crime, whenever any evil act is committed, that you might point to one person to be guilty for intentionally doing the crime or the bad thing. But then other people who are guilty kind of by compliance or to a lesser extent are those who just try to act like innocent bystanders and kind of just let the bad thing happen, right? So you can gotta be guilty in either of those ways, either just by being complacent and letting the bad thing happen or by actively causing a bad thing. And so with this being the bad thing that, you know, we have eroded our understanding that the Catholic Church is the true church and the source of all truth, I think on one hand, there are genuinely people who actively try to work against that truth. Like there are clergy, there are catechists, there have been clergy now for decades, even centuries, who have actively tried to work against the Catholic Church's teaching that we are the true church. And like that, you see kind of the first waves of that in modernism.
Yep, which is why Pope Pius X hated it so much.
Exactly. You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to mention Pius X wrote an encyclical about this called Pascendi Dominici Gregis all the way back in 1907. So this is the very beginning of the 20th century. And yeah, basically he was addressing modernism, which is this heresy that teaches essentially that all religions are equal, that all mindsets are to some extent equal, all worldviews are equal. They can all be different paths to God, and you can't say that one is inherently better than the others. So yeah, what was really interesting is in that papal encyclical, Pius X describes what the modernists believe, and one of the fundamental ideas that they believe is that your relationship with God or your your access to truth isn't defined by being part of one particular church, say the Catholic Church, but it's rather brought about by just having this, what's called the religious sense, which is this kind of feeling of inspiration or this feeling of connection to some spiritual reality or sort of this spiritual awareness. And the problem with that is that if you think that that's how you can access truth, then to some extent, every religion has a quote-unquote religious sense. You know, Muslims, Jews, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, they all have this awareness of God. And you go to any of those religions, you can find people in that religion that say they've had some sort of spiritual encounter. And so if that's the only basis for knowing whether or not you have absolute truth, then the problem is you wind up with a bunch of religions being on an equal playing field. And so he was calling that out, Pius X was calling that out all the way back in 1907 as being a major issue being pushed by clergy. This is not some, you know, outside force that's attacking the church or some army that's literally attacking the church's borders somewhere. He's saying this is going on in the clergy. So there are clergy actively pushing against the church's dogma and promoting this heresy of modernism. So that's one angle, I think, is just those people who are guilty of promoting modernism in our church. And they've been doing that now for over 100 years, going on 200 years.
And Pius X say that like modernism was a worse threat to the church than communism itself?
I appreciate, yes.
Yeah, which is crazy when you think about that.
He did, and the thing is, he called it the heresy of all heresies. It is like we hear modernism and sound sort of, oh, it must be one of those kind of harmless things because the modern world, you know, it's not quite right, but it's friendly, it's nice, and sometimes that's kind of how we might be tempted to think of modernism, is it's like kind of the friendly heresy because it's the heresy of just trying to get along with people. But in fact, it is the most insidious and dangerous heresy. It's the one that can lead most directly to hell because it encompasses every other heresy, right? Like, being an Arian or being a Sabellian or any other kind of heretic isn't a big deal compared to being a modernist, because at least all those other heresies assert some objective truth. It might be a wrong truth that violates one of the articles of our faith, but they at least assert a universal truth. But modernism just throws out universal truth altogether. It says, no, there is no absolute truth. There is no absolute religion. Everything's equal. Everything's fair. Everything goes. And so anyway, so sorry. So Pius is calling that out as an issue going on in the clergy. So there are clergy and catechists and teachers in Catholic schools who are actively promoting that heresy, which leads to this pluralistic mentality. So that's one half of it in terms of who's to blame for this issue. But then on the other side, there are all of us who have tried to be innocent bystanders and allowed modernism to be promoted and not taken an active stand to guard against it and to bash it down. And we do that sometimes. We justify it to ourselves and we rationalize our own complacency because we kind of try to act as if it's just us being friendly or ecumenical, right? Because we say, well, you know, sure, we might believe that the Catholic Church is the true church, but we don't want to push that on the people next to us. We don't want to push that on our neighbors.
Right.
We don't want to aggressively push that on Protestants. And sometimes we even say, look, we don't want to be aggressive in that way because we don't want to turn them off from the church. So see, in some kind of indirect way, we're helping the church if we don't so strongly push the dogma that outside the church there is no salvation. And so we kind of rationalize and sidestep the issue out of cowardice, essentially. It's a certain form of cowardice that says, well, we don't want to get into those awkward situations where we're having to stand up for the faith, so we'd rather kind of put a friendly face on it and act like there's no issue. And some of that is understandable. I think throughout all of church history, that's just one of the temptations that Christians go through, is that we're tempted by that spirit of cowardice to not stand up for Christ and to not promote our beliefs with confidence. But it's particularly made harder nowadays, I think, because of globalization. Because on social media platforms, you are immediately exposed to people of other mindsets and other worldviews, or even just in your backyard, right, in your own neighborhood, you're very likely to be next door neighbors to somebody of a totally different worldview from you. That wasn't necessarily the case, right, back in the 1200s. In medieval times, a Catholic lived on the other side of the known world from a Muslim. Nowadays, a Catholic could be next door to a Muslim, so you have this tension, which makes it really seem really appealing to just want to get along and not want to be aggressive and push your own faith. But then the problem is, it can be a way of permitting modernism to just keep going on.
Yeah, so
that was very long.
It's good. But it's good. No, that gave me a lot of things to respond to. I think especially in that last, what you said, just kind of like, okay, like maybe like shut up and like put your head down. Like, okay, yes, I believe that this is true, but like I'm not going to impose it on anyone. Like that we believe that harmony must be the guiding principle of life. And that harmony must be the guiding principle of all conversations. Like, okay, I don't want to rub anyone the wrong way. Which is like really interesting because a lot of other religions do not approach dialogue necessarily with that same principle of harmony.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, some of them sure might like in a more public setting, you know, like if they're, you know, you see the Pope, talking to the Dalai Lama or something, like the Dalai Lama is not going to be like aggressive, like how dare you not worship Buddha or something. But if you're meeting, like, you know, I know some more evangelical Protestants who are extremely aggressive, or, you know, Muslims, you know, I have a friend who's Muslim. He, you know, he never was like that, but he would admit that some of his friends were a lot more like, oh, nope. Everyone else is wrong. Like everyone else is dead wrong. And I'll like oppose them to their faces about that. So it, yeah. And I think it's like, whoa, And the world criticizes Christianity for not being harmonious or not being ecumenical. It's like, well, you're founder. If you truly believe that Jesus, you know, is God, God himself is love. Jesus is your founder, was always understanding of everyone. So you have to believe that principle, which means you accept everyone. It's like, gosh, like, no. And not that, no, Jesus didn't accept everyone, because he did, but Jesus never accepted everyone in a way that made them stay the way they were. He wasn't like, oh, good for you, pat you on the shoulder. Like, no, I think a good model of like dialogue or ecumenism is Jesus's interactions with both the woman caught in adultery and the woman at the well from John chapter 4. Because with the woman at the well, he brings her into conversation, recognizing where she is. He sees her as a person, clearly, you know, is willing and desirous to hear her side, but he invites her to something more. He invites her to a deeper experience of truth. And it requires her to admit that she was wrong, but then she sees the fullness of what could be if she lives a life, a truth of life with Christ. And then, you know, that the fullness of drinking in the living water is only the water that is available through the church. And then the woman caught in adultery, right? There's the Pharisees who are saying, you know, pick up stones. Moses says to kill her. What do you say, teacher? Well, when Jesus says, like, be the one who has no sin, be the first one to cast a stone, right? So people might tell Catholics, oh, in dialogue, see, you can't cast any stones. You can't tell anyone they're wrong. No, what does Jesus say? After that, neither do I condemn you, but you are forgiven. Go and sin no more. So don't return to the life you have. Your life has to be changed. So yes, I think that needs to be the encounter, like, that we desire in dialogue and ecumenism, is saying, like, okay, I'm not going to condemn you and tell you, oh my gosh, how dare you believe what you believe? You're so stupid. Or like, your religion is so false. Like, that's never going to convert anyone. But it's like, look, I'm not saying, like, you're wrong because you're simply you're wrong. I'm saying I can show you what is more true. I could read, there's even more. If you love what you have, imagine if you had more. So the church has as Tom mentioned, the fullness of truth. And these other religions, right, they wouldn't exist, or they wouldn't have people who could adhere to them for centuries if there wasn't some truth they were holding on to. But it can't be the wholeness of truth, because that would mean that if all of these religions were true, or all of them could lead to heaven, then that God himself is divided, that there are multiple ways to God. There's got to be one way to God. God is as simple. He's not complex in the fact that he's not made up of like different parts. He's all actuality. He's all one. So there are different things that are truths that are reflective of the one truth, that have bits and pieces, but there's only one way. There's only one way. And the Second Vatican Council, in its pastoral, or is it dogmatic institution, dogmatic constitution on the church in the universal, the church in the world, Lumen Gentium, says that the Catholic Church is the church. That the church that Jesus founded subsists, or it exists solely in the Catholic Church. Therefore, truth completely only exists in totality in the Catholic Church. And therefore, salvation only comes through the church. So that if people believe that, okay, other religions lead to heaven, no, we would not say that word, lead. Like, that's a really bad word to say, other religions lead to heaven. Other religions, believed properly by the person, if they had no encounter with Jesus ever, cause them to live a life of virtue, then sure, we don't condemn them to hell just because they didn't know Jesus, if they didn't have any opportunity to. But it's not their religion that gets them there. It's Christ, salvation, which is distributed to the world only through the church. And if we really want them to experience the fullness of grace, then we should desire them to be in the church now and not just kind of live in, oh, ignorance, because, well, you know, if, say, St. Paul says, like, well, how, you know, how would they hear of him if there's no one to preach? So that's our mission. We have to do something. We have to be the ones to preach. But if they hear and then don't do anything about it, that's on them. But we have to take that preaching into our role. But if most Catholics believe, like, oh, all religion saved, then they have no motivation to preach. So my thoughts then, the question to you guys is, Like, how can we be more active in that? How can we be more active in, like, being definitive about what we believe about the fullness of truth in the church? How can we share the message of, like, in the church only is there salvation through the church only? And yeah, I don't know. How do you even start this conversation? What do you do? And what do you go about when you do them? Tom, I mean, you said you had a guy who you walked with for like 10 years. So, you know, what was that like?
Yeah, I think you hit on it pretty well there, Sam. When you, I'll start with how it ends, because you already enunciated, which is the invitation. There has to eventually be an invitation to the truth. You know, life is kind of short. You never know when somebody is going to get hit by a car, succumb to sickness. I mean, like, we have to have a little bit of a carpe diem kind of approach in some ways to inviting people to the truth. It can't just be, well, you know, I'm going to try to be a nice person around them, you know, let this candle shine. Although that's part of it, not saying that's not part of it, but that there does have to come a time when you land the plane and you invite them. And it's not, well, sometimes it may just be as simple as inviting them to Mass. It may be that simple, because don't forget that we don't have to be the only voice. And I think that's one thing that a couple of these, and like even the recent situation that I referred to, I don't think I was the only voice. I'm not going to play single-handed, you know, Catholic hero on this one.
Yeah.
But we can be a voice and a clear one still. But it does, I don't think it necessarily starts out of the gate with the invitation. And that's where, you know, I think I have some friends who probably have a little bit more of that mentality of like, basically don't waste any time, cut to the chase. And in a certain sense, I respect that. In another sense, I think there is kind of a reality that has to set in, which is, again, you know, in this particular instance, knew the guy for about 10 years through the army. And we had many opportunities to talk about, you know, the deep questions in life, the pains we all go through, the challenges, the temptations, you know, and kind of what you make of that. And I think the thing that probably wore him down, if one could say that I was a part of that, which I think is fair, is that I was always pretty willing to talk about how, you know, how my faith has played a role in my life. And I think that's the one thing, again, just don't play down the role that just talking about being in love with our faith. And for me, like, and I was just talking about this with Johanna, my wife, the other day, like, I'm not 100% sure I would still be Catholic or Christian without a real love of the Eucharist and just having felt like I've really encountered Christ in the Eucharist. And that's not something that is purely based out of like some sort of rationalization in my mind, some ability to connect the dots from a philosophical standpoint. That's just about being there right in front of our Creator in the Eucharist, and just coming to believe, because the closer you get to Him physically, I think the easier it is to be closer to Him spiritually, mentally, etc. So I think just being able to talk about being in love with Christ in the Eucharist is a very powerful thing. That's not to say that everybody follows that route. I know, you know, people like Scott Hahn would talk about learning about the early church and the early church fathers is a very key part of their conversions. I think we've heard that a few times. The more history you read, the more you're going to be like, oh man, this. I guess they're the ones that got the ball rolling. So yeah, what it has to end in, to answer your question, is an invitation. But you know, in my experience, it does begin with a conversation and getting to know somebody. You know, it'd be cool if Catholics were good at, say, something like going door to door and converting people, but I'm not entirely sure that that's actually what we're called to. And even if it were, there always needs to be a relationship there. So anyway, that's what I'll say is, it's not always an instantaneous thing, and patience is part of that too. So what about you, Nate?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what you just described was spot on. I feel like I don't have any radical points to add to that, but just like pointing out just a couple maybe extremes that you don't want to fall into. It seems like But admittedly, this is a hard thing to do. Like, that's one thing that's just worthwhile to acknowledge. Because sometimes people get fired up and say, like, you know what? I just want to bring others to Christ. And it's like, that's great. That's awesome. You should have that zeal. But, you know, recognize and acknowledge that it's not always easy. And it's sometimes messy. Sometimes it's embarrassing and awkward. Because just like two extremes I thought of. There's the one extreme where you think, oh, you know what? I just want to right out of the gates. Like, the first thing I say to someone is, allow me to tell you about our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Right. I'm like, can I invite you to Mass? I hardly know your name, but let me take you to Mass. There's that extreme, and we know we should avoid that. And we hear things like, you know, if you want to bring someone into the church and into the faith and introduce them to Christ, you should develop a friendship with them first. And so we start developing a friendship. But then you don't want your friendship just to be like a means. Mm-hmm. So you try to deepen it a little bit more. Well, now suddenly, hold on, you have a deep friendship and you feel like it'd be awkward to bring up faith suddenly because, like, you really like this guy and you don't want things to suddenly be weird between you two. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's different elements that make it complicated, right, and make it a little bit awkward. But I think just a couple extremes to avoid are the first one I mentioned, yeah, just initiating a relationship purely on the basis of, hey, I don't even know who you are, but become Catholic. That's just a bad idea. It's not going to work. The Mormon approach just does not work. But you also don't want to go to the other extreme where you have a relationship so long and so deeply immersed and you've never brought up faith at all, right? Like you do want to, if you have a good friendship with someone, if you really love them and you will their good and you desire them to go to heaven, you should have some sense of urgency. Like Tom said, you should have a carpe diem mentality, a little bit of a YOLO mentality. You should say, okay, we all only live once. I don't know. We could all die tomorrow. So you don't want to miss that opportunity to extend that invitation to one of the homies. But as far as how to do that, I think there's just real quick, another two extremes that I thought of. Mm-hmm. Once you're extending that invitation, which is on one hand, like when you are developing this friendship with somebody and through it, you're hoping to evangelize them. You don't have to go to the two extremes of either one just being you only have superficial, friendly, buddy conversations, and then suddenly out of nowhere you say, hey, have you ever thought about being Catholic? Like, yeah. You shouldn't do that. But you also, like, all your conversations don't have to be, let me teach you about this doctrine. Let me teach you about this article of faith. Allow me to tell you about St. Athanasius and the early church fathers. Yep. Like, what you can do is you can have instead conversations that bridge the gap. Instead of things being just superficial or purely relating to our dogma and things that are like exactly Catholic, instead just start by opening the door to deep conversations of any kind, right? Mm-hmm. Philosophical conversations, asking the person how they feel about death, asking the person what they think might happen after death, asking people about what they think might be the origin of the universe, talking to them, listen to their opinions, don't just like impose your own, but like hear where they're coming from, because you might have like prepared answers like, oh, you know, I think I'm gonna prove this or that to them and I studied all this apologetics, but in reality that might not be at all relevant to what they themselves think or believe. So, you know, ask those deep questions. Ask them, what do you think constitutes beauty? What do you think about truth? Do you think there's such a thing as absolute truth? Get these background questions going, deep questions that don't, where you've never said the word Catholic, you've never said the Nicene Creed in front of them, but you're opening the door to these deep conversations so that then it's a more natural transition. Once you've already started talking about death in like an abstract way and what they believe about death, then you can start bringing the idea of eternity and heaven and hell, rather than just abruptly saying, hey, do you know where you're going if you die? Right, are you, right. You think you're going to heaven or hell? Like, no, that's just going to be jarring. It's going to be out of left field. And again, this is not you don't want to take this balanced approach purely for the sake of you know, just being friendly and getting along and not hurting anybody's feelings. It's not about that. It's about actually what is most effective. Being jarring and being, like going going the Mormon route is just not the most effective. If you actually want someone to have a deep level conversion, you have to open their mind to just deeper ways of thinking. That's all I got.
Yeah. You know, there was several things I thought of along the way. I don't know if I'll remember them all, or if they're all worth reiterating. But something, you know, Tom mentioned, and I'm hearing from you, Nate, too, is something Pope Benedict says, which is Christianity is not a sum of, like, teachings and philosophies. It is a relationship with a person. And like comparing like other religions to Christianity, none of them claim a level of relationship that Christianity claims with our God. Like no other religion claims the relationship that God became a human. So we're distinct in that form of relationship. And then comparing Catholicism to Protestantism, Catholicism is the only one that claims that not only did God become human, but God becomes our food in the Eucharist. So we have even a deeper relationship that we claim in Catholicism. So if we're desiring to bring people into the truth, it's what we're truly desiring to bring them in into is the most full expression, the full reality of relationship that they can have with God. And that, in a sense, for me, it's not more like saying, oh, you know, believe this, do this, da da da. But wouldn't you want, if this is God who loves you, if this is the one who created you and sees you, wouldn't you want the best possible relationship you could have with him? If you are married to a spouse or you have a best friend, wouldn't you want to do everything you possibly could to have the best friendship, the best marriage with him that you possibly could have? Why would you want anything else? And if I was to tell you that my faith, we truly believe, has the best way to do that because compared to other religions, God became human. Compared to Protestantism, our God is in deepest relationship in our very persons through the Eucharist. That is different. There's something different there. And as far as like engaging in dialogue and relationships, you said, Nate, like maybe not saying like, well, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. Okay, let's begin with what it means to have Trinitarian theology, blah, blah, blah. But I think a good place to start is morality too. Like people are so confused about how to act. And we kind of like, I mean, we throw like higher truths or more abstract ideas, metaphysics, whatever, just like completely out the window anymore. That's not, we don't even think about that. I mean, there's just moral relativism is so confusing for people, regardless of religious relativism. And so people don't even know what to do with their lives. If I'm like, well, I know an institution that was founded not by humans, it was founded by God that has guidelines for how to just live and not live by dictate, but by living in freedom and living in joy, and living like a full expression of humanity. That's the church. So that morality is not a set of rules. It's actually like the proper bounds to have a healthy relationship. If a marriage doesn't have healthy bounds that define what that relationship is, it's not a good relationship. It's like, oh, you enter in marriage, but it's not monogamous, or we can cheat on each other if we want, or maybe it'll last for 20 years, but at the end, you know, if you don't feel like it, you're done. Like, if all of those were part of that relationship, it would never be good even while you're in it. Even if you were living it monogamously, even if you were living it towards, in hopes until death do us part, if those things were still options on the table, you would never be lived well. So the same, I think, holds true for faith. That if you're like, well, I'm going to believe that Jesus is God, or I'm going to believe that I can go to heaven, but I'm going to say that along the way to get there are no boundaries, then you'll never actually live that journey well. It's completely pointless. And that offering those truths in the church to people, I think, is a great avenue too. I don't know if you had any reactions to that. Maybe last closing thoughts. Don't want to drag too long today, but if you got any responses to that.
Sorry to cut you off. I just want to say I really appreciate kind of the tail end of what you were just saying, because that seems to address the I'm spiritual but not religious crowd. Because I think that's a very common thing nowadays. And even among people who profess some belief in a monotheistic God, or even some belief in Jesus Christ, they live their life not according to any set of principles, but it's more this mentality of being spiritual but not religious. And I think it's just really important to point out to those people the impracticality of that lifestyle and the uncertainty that it gives. Also the lack of joy that it leads to. It doesn't lead to a fulfilling life, but it leads to a more aimless, wandering life and one that's void of satisfaction. But just one real quick thing about, I think, how we can do that, and also just how we can introduce religion in a down-to-earth way to just anybody, is no matter what somebody's background is, no matter what their worldview is, no matter what their religion is, everybody believes in evil.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you know, I've met people of all different religions and different worldviews. I have never met anybody who thought that the Nazis were chill. I never thought someone is like, oh yeah, you know, Hitler, you know, killing tons of Jews or 9/11 or
crazy people though.
Okay, there are some psychos, but the vast majority of non-psychopathic people will at least grant to you that there are things that are bad. And if you can get someone to grant you that there are things that are bad, then you're already halfway to them admitting that there's such a thing as something good. And that there has to, if there's definitive things that are definitively bad, then there has to be some things that are definitively good and true and beautiful. Mm. And then that goes for moral actions in terms of there are things that are acceptable and unacceptable for ways of life, but it also goes for beliefs and religions. So that's just one thing I was thinking of is, yeah, honestly, if people look at the problem of evil as kind of the great checkmate to Christianity, but in reality, if you can get somebody to acknowledge the problem of evil and to actually flesh it out a little bit, and just see their own perspective on it, their own perception of evil, then you're kind of halfway to helping them recognize goodness and truth and beauty.
Yeah. I had a professor say, like, you know, people's like, oh, you know, if God exists, why does evil exist? Like, okay, well, if God doesn't exist, then why does goodness exist? So, yeah. Cool. Thanks, Nate. Tom, any final remarks or reactions or thoughts on anything?
No, but I think you guys all just kind of had some good points, and even just, again, to reinforce what Nate was saying, I think having deep conversations, being more than superficial with people is a big part. Yeah, because, you know, life is short and it's good to have fun with your buddies. It's good to have laughs and not take everything so seriously all the time. But got to remember, we're not made for here, you know, and whether it's like that momentary sense of kind of maybe a little bit of embarrassment that we might feel sometimes when we pull back the curtain and be like, yeah, I actually care deeply about my faith. I'm one of those, you know, religious weirdos or whatever, you know, like it's okay. We're not meant to live here. We have to be courageous about that, and have those deep conversations. But yeah, that's, you know, like it's very meaningful. And the other thing about that is, even if it doesn't, again, have those kind of immediate desired effects, in my experience, most people, as long as you have those conversations with like love and respect and sort of a meaningful, like, hey, I care about you, like you said, Nate, you know, for authentic love for the good of the other, it comes out when you do it right. When you do it the wrong way, whether it's too rushed or too out of the gates or too callously, you know, then it can sometimes get the, okay, this is like a, you know, what are the missionary dating scenario, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Exactly.
But when it's done right, it's more often than not going to be well received. And I mean, like, I know you guys have, and I know I've had conversations with people who are not only like, you know, from a philosophical or religious standpoint, hold different views, but their lifestyles are very much in opposition to the church, you know, and that's where things get tricky too, because most people probably can have like a fairly academic discussion, if you will, on stuff they believe. Mm-hmm. What gets tricky is where the rubber meets the road, and when you're kind of calling them to change how they're living in a way, and yeah, where accepting the truth is going to mean, oh, you mean I can't, you know, do this thing that I've been doing for years, or like that somehow like this way of life is inherently in opposition to this worldview. Mm-hmm. That's tricky.
Yeah.
So, that's where having those deep conversations, being willing to talk about the tough stuff, it's all good. It's something to be courageous about too, though, and not just let silently slip by and just wait, you know, waiting for some golden opportunity to drop in your lap, because it might not.
Mm.
So that's it. Dude. Anyway, yeah, love the conversation though. Good perspectives from you, gents. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you too, guys. Yeah, give me some good things. Go ahead, Nate.
Bro, I'm so sorry. Can I just say, this will take 1 minute. Just one other thing popped in my head. One other thing I thought of is, and something Tom said reminded me of this, with those deep conversations, but even like kind of vulnerability, is when you're trying to evangelize somebody, don't be afraid to share with them your own sinfulness even. Because I think, for one thing, we might be afraid to scandalize someone, but I think recognizing, because Tom, you brought up that it might be jarring or hard for someone when you're introducing them to the faith, but they have to recognize maybe their own lifestyle would have to change if they accepted the faith.
And I think it's really helpful with those kind of people to say, to tell them, look, I too have had to work on my lifestyle and I've had to work on my own daily moral choices because I'm flawed. I'm sinful. I've made mistakes. I need mercy too. We're all in this together in a way. We're all kind of, you know, we're all sinners that need to be saved by grace. I think it was Fulton Sheen or I don't remember exactly who it was, but somebody compared the Catholic Church. They said the best way to visualize the Catholic Church is one beggar telling another beggar where to find food. And that's just that very humble, vulnerable state in which we need to approach other people saying, hey, this has worked for me. This has changed my life from being a wreck to being something beautiful. And this can work for you too. You're not like, you know, an untouchable just because you feel like you have baggage. We've all been there. And I think rather than that being a possibility for scandal, that can actually help them be like, oh wow, these Catholics can recognize their own sinfulness. Because sometimes people get turned off by hearing about this weird double standard where, you know, priests are sadly, you know, even among our clergy, but just Catholics in general, will do bad scandalous things, but then meanwhile kind of preach as if they're holier than thou good people. And so people get disillusioned with those who talk the talk but can't walk the walk. Sometimes it's useful with those people to say, look, I'm trying to walk the walk, but I don't always do it perfectly. And so you don't have to be perfect either if you want to become a Catholic.
Yeah. Good deal. Appreciate you guys. Thanks for the convo. And hopefully all you watching and listening, you know, learned something, received something, motivated you towards something. If you want to, you know, ask questions about how to respond to certain criticisms or things that people have asked you, and you're not really sure how to respond, feel free to drop a comment below. We'd love to respond. And if, you know, you're going back and forth about this idea of the church, outside of the church being no salvation, we can respond to that. We'd love to. It's like, yeah, sometimes we can't engage in dialogue with other people because we've never even engaged in dialogue with one another. If we can't bring something we don't have to other people, and we might not have it if we don't even offer it to one another. So yeah, check out our other podcast episodes where we, you know, talk about maybe challenging or more difficult things within the church. You can check out this episode on liturgy, and you can check out another episode here. So it'll be a surprise. So yeah, thank you, Tom and Nate. Appreciate you guys for being on. Thank you all for listening. Hope you have a wonderful God bless day.